Devaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. This morning we are reading Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 10, Chapter 24, Text Number 14. Asti ched Ishvaram kaschit phalam rupi anya karmanam kartaram bhajate so api na hi akartu prabhu hi Asti ched Ishvara kaschit phala rupyanya karmanam kartaram bhajate sopi nahi akartu prabhur hi saha. Asti ched Ishvara kaschit phala rupi anya karmanam kartaram bhajate sopi nahi akartu prabhur hi saha. Asti ched Ishvara kaschit phala rupi anya karmanam kartaram bhajate sopi nahi akartu prabhur hi saha. There is chet If hypothetically, Ishvaram, a supreme controller, kashchit, someone, phalarupi, serving to award fruitive results, anyakarmanam, of the activities of other persons, kartaram, the performer of activity, bhajate, depends upon, sa, he, api, even, na, not, he, after all, akartu, of one who performs no activity, prabhu, the master, he, certainly, saha, he, the capital H this time. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. Even if there is some supreme controller who awards all others the results of their activities, he must also depend upon a performer's engaging in activity. After all, there's no question of being the bestower of fruitive results unless fruitive activities have actually been performed. Krishna is arguing, giving arguments to his father. Please repeat. Even if there is some supreme controller who awards all others the results of their activities, he must also depend on, upon a performer's engaging in activity. After all, there is no question of being the bestower of fruitive results, unless fruitive activities have actually been performed. Purport by the disciples of Srila Prabhupada. Here, Lord Krishna argues that if there is a supreme controller, he must depend on a performer of activity to reciprocate with, and must therefore also be subject to the laws of karma, being obliged to award happiness and distress to conditioned souls according to the laws of good and evil. This superficial argument neglects the obvious point that the laws of nature that prescribe the good and bad results of pious and impious acts are themselves creations of the all-good Supreme Lord. Being the creator and sustainer of these laws, the Lord is not subject to them. Furthermore, the Lord is not dependent on the work of the conditioned souls, since he is satisfied and complete within himself. Out of his all-merciful nature, he awards the results appropriate to our activities. That which we call destiny, fate, or karma is an elaborate and subtle system of rewards and punishments meant for gradually encouraging conditioned souls to evolve to the stage of perfect consciousness, which is their original constitutional nature. The Supreme Personality of Godhead has so dexterously formulated and applied the laws of material nature, governing punishment and reward for human behavior, that the living being is discouraged from sin and encouraged towards goodness without suffering any significant interference with his free will as an eternal soul. In contrast to the material nature, the Lord exhibits his essential nature in the spiritual world, where he reciprocates the eternal love of his pure devotees. Such loving affairs are based completely on the mutual freedom of the Lord and his devotees, not on a mechanical reciprocity of coinciding selfish interests. Yeah, I'm just emphasizing that because it's pretty compact. The Supreme Lord, assisted by his pure devotees, repeatedly offers the conditioned souls of this world the opportunity to give up their bizarre attempt at exploiting the material universe and go back home, back to Godhead, for an eternal life of bliss and knowledge. Considering all these points, the atheistic arguments given here by Lord Krishna in a playful mood are not to be taken seriously. The verse once again, even if there is some supreme controller who awards all others the results of their activities, he must also depend upon a performer's engaging in activity. After all, there is no question of being the bestower of fruitive results unless fruitive activities have actually been performed. Om Ajnana Timirandasya Jananjana Shalakya Chakshun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurve Namaha. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. If you'll allow me, before I begin the class, one little announcement is that in the newsletter there was a mistake, and I just want to correct it because my dear godbrother, Dravida Prabhu, I don't want him to be upset with me. It said that it was describing what I'm all about, and it stated that I've been a long-time BBT editor. So that was confusing me with Dravida, or I don't know, somehow that mistake entered into the newsletter. So please understand that although I worked at BTG, I was just dealing with the accounts in 1980 and 1990. I wanted to be even an apprentice proofreader, but I didn't get that privilege. So I have no, that's not me. I'm not a long-time editor of BBT. I like to read the BBT books and talk about them, but I don't. Sometimes what I do is they have a website called Errors BBT, and when I see errors in the books, to me appears to be errors, whatever kind of error, I send it in. And sometimes I'm thanked for that. So if any of you see errors, you can send it in. Maybe you'll catch a new one. Okay, now down to business. As introduction, I'll just read the menu of what we'll discuss. About five or six things. First, we'll discuss that the Supreme Lord is never subject to his own laws. Then we'll say something about the fact that and this is actually a quote from Prabhupada in the introduction to the first canto, Bhagavatam, the conception of God and the conception of absolute truth are not on the same level. So we'll say a little about that. Third, and this is pretty substantial, will take probably at least half of the time of the class, is the modern scientist's fundamental fallacy. Maybe they have a few fundamental fallacies, but one of them comes up in the context of today's verse and purport. Number four, an apparent contradiction. within the purport, there seemed to be a contradiction. So we'll point that out, and then we'll see if we can come up with a solution. And then there'll be a couple of questions that I'll ask, but we won't have time to answer those questions. So when we study Bhakti Shastri, you know the name they use for that? They're called car park questions. They just put it in the car park. Sometimes a secretary in the class will make a list on a board, you know, all the list of car park questions. Very often we never get to those ever, but the idea is that in our own time, in our own studies, we try to, and then if we, you know, we could bring it up in the future with other devotees. Not this, we'll see, maybe we don't even have time for that. So number one, first topic, the Supreme Lord is never subject to his own laws. As it is said, and as Srila Prabhupada would sometimes quote, the king can do no wrong. In other words, the Supreme Lord, just like a king, in traditional society, is never subject to his own laws, neither in terms of his own person, nor in terms of how he controls those ourselves who obviously are subject to these laws. In other words, there seemed to be an innuendo in the purport that Krishna was arguing, maybe he was, that if there's some supreme controller, here's the supreme controller speaking, but he's speaking playfully, if there were some supreme controller, then he would be obliged to perform, because after all, the modes of nature and karma, those are supreme. This is in the line of karma and mimamsa philosophy. So the Supreme Lord would be subject to those laws. I don't know if Krishna was meant to imply that this supreme controller would also be himself performing fruitive activities. Maybe he did mean that. But at least it's quite clear that Krishna is saying that the laws, since the laws of nature are supreme, then the Lord, the some supreme Lord, would be compelled. He would be under the laws of karma in the sense that he would be obliged to, forced in a sense, to give the results of fruitive activity to everyone. But actually, the Supreme Lord is never subject to his own laws. Now I'm turning. Okay. We have some references to that. 414. Oh yeah. Namam karmani limpanti name karma phalesh biha. How's that going? Itimam yo vichanati karma bir na sabhajyate. It follows the Chatur Vanyan Vyashrishtam verse where Krishna is saying, it says, Tasya akartaram apimam vidhi akartaram avya. That even though I'm the creator of that system called Vanashram Dharma, it's like a big work, right? But still, I'm not part of that system. I remain the non-doer. In other words, Krishna's not performing any fruitive activities. And one who knows this truth about me also becomes free from the results of fruitive activities. In other words, Krishna does things, but he doesn't do things in the sense of being a doer as we are in the material world, that kind of doer that we're kind of buying into the whole system of karma. Krishna doesn't have that problem. And the same point is made later on in the Bhagavad Gita when Krishna describes a bigger work that he engages, Prakritim Spam Abhastavya Vistijamu Punak Punak, etc. He creates and destroys the whole universes over and over again. And then again, he makes the same point, but I don't get any karmic reactions. Nachamam tani karmani nibhajyanti dananjaya udasina vadasinam ashakta teshu karmashu. I don't become nibhajyanti, I don't become bound up. I remain neutral, and I don't. I'm not attached to the results of work. Now, in Brahma Sangita, it's described that yes, Krishna does, in a kind of neutral way, yastindra gopa matavendra husva karma bandana rupa falabhajana matanuti. He gives the results of karma. We can say in his aspect of supersoul. In the neutral way. Just like in Bhagavad Gita in chapter 9, Krishna says that I'm not envious of anyone, I'm not partial, I don't favor anyone, I'm neutral. But then there's a caveat to that, there's an exception to that. In the case of an individual in the material world who starts turning to me, it's like the two birds, one bird starts looking at the other bird, then something very special happens. Karmani nirdahati kintu chabakti bhajan. Then he reduces the karmic reactions down to nil. That's why a devotee, a real devotee, tatenu kumam sushamikshamana ivatma bunjanam ivatma kritam vibhakam vidvad vibhuvir vidatannam aste jivetiyo mukti pade sadayabhak. He doesn't resent, he doesn't feel that Krishna has betrayed him when some pain comes. He understands. His understanding is that I deserve much more than this. I'm just getting a little token of my previous sinful activities. The Lord is so kind. And such a personality who has that mentality is a fit candidate for ultimate liberation. It has become his rightful claim. So the Lord is required for administering these things and also for going beyond the law of nature known as karma. Now this, what I was just discussing, also pertains to the next topic, which we'll call number 2. As Srila Prabhupada states in the introduction to the first canto, and I'll read a quote here, the conception of God and the conception of the Absolute Truth are not on the same level. The Srimad Bhagavatam hits on the target of the Absolute Truth. The conception of God indicates the controller, whereas the conception of the Absolute Truth indicates the summum bonum, or the ultimate source of all energies. There's no difference of opinion about the personal feature of God as the controller, because a controller cannot be impersonal. Or in other words, religions which go only as far as the concept of Ishvara as the supreme controller, we do bond with them, we agree with them that this supreme controller is a person. So there's no difference of opinion in that sense. Then a little later in this part of the purport or the introduction to the first canto, Srila Prabhupada goes on to state, because there are different controllers for different managerial positions, there may be many small gods. According to the Bhagavad Gita, any controller who has some specific extraordinary power is called a vibhutimat sattva, or controller empowered by the Lord. There are many vibhutimat sattvas, controllers or gods with various specific powers, but the Absolute Truth is one without a second. This Srimad Bhagavatam designates the Absolute Truth as the summum bonum, as the Param Satyam. Of course, the first verse, Param Satyam Dimahi. Why do I worship Krishna or Vasudeva as the Absolute Truth? Because he's the supreme controller? Well, that's a pretty good reason. But there's even a deeper reason. I worship him because he is the Absolute Truth. Okay, then, now, what I'll do is something, a little trick I tried last night in the Bhagavad Gita class, and it really worked nicely. I have a tendency to go overtime, and that's a great sin in speaking Bhagavatam. So, to avoid that happening, I'll ask you the same favor that I asked the smaller audience last night, is bear with me. I'm giving my own little realizations, but I'm reading what I wrote, so don't become bored. I mean, of course, it shouldn't be bored anyway, but if I'm reading Srila Prabhupada's words or directly a translation of a verse, I'll let you know that. Otherwise, I'm reading something that I just wrote last night, and this is an example of it. Okay, here we go. So even though, and the reason I'm doing it saves a lot of time, that way I won't fall into the temptation to digress, and then, you know, it's a problem. So even though Krishna is here hypothetically accepting the existence of, quote, some supreme controller, unquote, in the ultimate analysis, it is the Absolute Truth, Param Satyam, which resolves any and all doubts concerning karma, creation, ourselves, or what have you. Now, you may have some question about that, and try to remember whatever question you may have, and we can discuss a little later. Third topic. The modern scientist's fundamental fallacy is indicated in this verse and purport. For them, chance and the laws of physics explain everything. These are my words. Krishna hopefully inspired me. From the microcosm to the macrocosm. Chance and the laws of physics explain everything from the microcosm to the macrocosm. Here, Krishna's argument, in a sense, anticipates their error. Of course, Kali Yuga is just kicking in soon after Krishna has performed his Leela 5,000 years ago, which is to eliminate the error, which is to eliminate the ultimate jurisdiction of the Supreme Lord, the supreme feature of the Absolute Truth, Bhagavan. They would rather understand that not only all phenomena, but even the origin of everything follows the laws of nature. Now I have A, one, A. I guess these are two examples. So what they say, oh yeah, in the case of the macrocosm of the cosmos, they believe that the universe just exploded into being from the Big Bang, which came out of essentially nothing. You could read in Origins magazine, one issue of the magazine, one issue magazine, a wonderful, wonderful literature in about 1985 or so it came out. And the whole idea of the Big Bang, although, you know, things have changed a little bit after all these years, but the essential arguments there are still extremely valid, all the arguments. And also we had an article in Back to Godhead magazine called The Big Bang Construction Company. You might remember that. And it said, here's a way you can save a lot of money on your house, and also it gets built instantaneously. You just order what design you want in the house, you buy the materials, and our workers will stack up all the materials in different piles, and here comes the amazing part. We're the only company that does this. We get about 15 big sticks of dynamite, and we push the plunger, and there's a huge explosion, and all your materials go up in the air, and they all just fall into place. In about 10 minutes, you have your dream house. Well, that construction company is also a dream construction company, because things don't really work like that. What to speak of not answering the question is who set up the explosion. That also is not explained by this amazing theory. And the second, in terms of the microcosm, although Krishna clearly states that I am the life of all that lives, that's in the seventh chapter of Bhagavad Gita, our scientific, actually scientistic, that's not a word in the dictionary, but there is a word, scientism. Nagaraj Prabhu wrote a nice editorial, and there he is, in Back to Godhead magazine a few years ago, explaining to us the difference between science and scientism. Remember that? And it's very edifying. So I'm just inventing a word, scientistic, as opposed to scientific. So all our scientific, actually scientistic friends insist that all forms of life, from amoebas up to humans, they don't place much stock in demigods, are caused by nothing more than chance. In other words, random mutations guided by natural selection. It is a bit amusing that here the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Bhagavan Sri Krishna, is advocating the supremacy of the laws of nature without even questioning who created such sophisticated laws. In other words, here is the personality who is the lawmaker. He created the laws, and he creates, maintains, and destroys. He is the supreme doer, although he's not under the law of karma. And he himself is speaking in this playful way and advocating karma mimamsa, which kind of lends itself to the modern scientistic point of view, as I'm calling it. Well, the scientism, as opposed to science, is not really science because it artificially creates a cognitive constraint that anything that implies supernatural, anything that implies some unseen or, you know, spiritual element, what to speak of God, is verboten. It's completely held at bay. It's kept at bay. It doesn't come to invade what they consider the sanctuary of actual real science. Nothing to do with such hypotheses as God or even spirit. So, let's see. It's amazing that Krishna himself is... So what I'm trying to get at here is that this karma mimamsa lends itself to this modern so-called scientific, more exactly scientistic point of view, although I'm just inventing that word. And that, in turn, also seems quite compatible with Buddhism. We find Buddhism is really, really popular now in the Western world, especially in America. Because then you have laws of nature, you have karma, but there's no God, there's no spiritual soul. There's just the information that reincarnates, transmigrates. So, and that was even mentioned. I noticed that Ridhananda Maharaj, he must have gotten it from Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur. So I was looking in the other day, we heard a description of this Karma Mimamsa philosophy as basically a belief in reincarnation, but essentially atheistic. In other words, it's atheism with reincarnation. So it's the same animal, what we're discussing here. So Krishna's not even questioning who created such sophisticated laws. For instance, we read in this purport we've just heard, that which we call destiny, fate, or karma is an elaborate and subtle system of awards and punishments meant for gradually encouraging conditioned souls to evolve to the stage of perfect consciousness. So if something as relatively simple as a house or a building cannot have been built by the Big Bang Construction Company, what to speak of something so refined and so, as the word in the purport, dexterously elaborated as the law of karma and the workings of karma, that infallible justice? How could that have come out just by chance? Okay. But not to speak of the subtle law of karma, or what to speak of the subtle law of karma, even such laws of such as gravity, of motion, of thermodynamics, cannot be just explained away that it happened by chance. There must have been an incredibly great lawmaker, although he is, in a sense, denying or hiding himself in these verses. Of course, in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna speaks much more directly and seriously about this subject. Bhagavad Gita, chapter 7, text 7, Matak Paratanam Nyanyet, chapter 9, text 10, you all know the verse, Maya Dakshena Prakriti Suyate Sacharachanam, by the Iksha, by his glance, everything is supervised, although Durga Devi is involved with creation and maintenance and destruction, but ultimately it's Krishna. Of course, he himself is described in second canto in Bhagavatam, Vishvam Purusha Rupena, he becomes the maintainer also, and the guna avatar, Kshirdakshay Vishnu, the mode of directing the mode of goodness, which is to maintain. Yes, we need maintenance. It's not exactly, as Newton was suggesting, a clockwork universe, although Newton, I believe, accommodated the idea that although it's like a big clock, and it is, the universe is like a big machine, but like any machine, it needs maintenance. So yes, the Lord comes, of course we know, not only from time to time, himself or in his personal expansions, incarnations, avatars, but he's also a permanent presence, during the duration of the cosmic manifestation as Kshirodakshay Vishnu, as Supasoul, and is maintaining everything. Lord Brahma is creating, Lord Shiva is destroying, and Lord Vishnu, as Kshirodakshay Vishnu, is maintaining. This is also confirmed in Bhagavatam, it's Kapila's teachings in Canto 3, chapter 25, text 42. Let's see if I remember. Madbayat vatavato yam shurastapati madbayat vashantindro dahatyagnir mrityushcharati madbayat. It is out of fear of me that the wind blows. It is out of fear of me that the sun is giving off so much heat and light, is shining, suyas, tapati. It is out of fear of me that Indra, and this is very pertinent to this section in Bhagavatam, is sending forth rain, barshat indro. And it is out of fear of me, the hat yagni, that fire burns. And it is even out of fear of me that death goes around, Rityush Charati, death goes around making his rounds and collecting us all. That is also out of fear of me. Five cosmic powers are representative and five personalities who are the demigods in charge of those functions. They all do their jobs out of fear of me. This isn't just some supreme controller that Krishna is alluding to, but this is the actual him, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Also, we have a very clear confirmation that things just don't go on just by themselves. Karma na daivinetre na jantur deho papadyate shtyovishtaram udaram. What is it? Pumshareta kanashrayaha. Yes, because of karma, because of our previous activities, we take birth in a particular womb of a particular mother, having taken shelter in the semen of a particular father. Yes, that's there, but it's not just karma. It's karma na daivi netrena. There's also the superior direction of the demigods and ultimately of the deva-deva jagatpate, of the god of gods, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Sri Krishna. All right, let me see if we... This is a very inexpensive computer, and the keyboard is it's so touchy, it keeps jumping around. But anyway, I'm not complaining. So we have examples. I already mentioned Big Bang Construction Company. We'll have two more examples. We have Yamaraj, the Lord of Death, and we have Yamaraj Das Prabhu of Back to Godhead magazine, who is, I think, listening to this class at a remote location. So in the case of Yamaraj, yes, it indicates, why if it's just karma supreme, then everyone would get their just desserts automatically. But no, you have a supreme judge, high court judge, Yamaraj, who as Dharmaraj, he deals with the pious, and as Yamaraj, he deals with the sinners. And so he's an intelligent judge. He's making decisions. There's some intervention there. It's not just automatically by the karma, people go to heaven, people go to hell. There's personality there. And what about our dear godbrother, Yamaraj Prabhu? Well, does the Back to Godhead magazine, you write all the articles and everything, and then as far as the whole beautiful design that comes out every month, or is it every 2 months now? Is it month or 2 months? 2 months, right? Every 2 months? Is that like the Big Bang Construction Company? Does you just throw it all together and just hit any buttons, or you just throw some rocks at the computer and it hits some keys and automatically it comes? No, we have an intelligent designer. And his name is Yamaraj Das Prabhu. So, I mean, it's obvious that there is intelligent design. That's the microcosm. There is fine tuning of the universe. That's the macrocosm. There's no doubt about this. Okay, let's go on to the next topic. It's called an apparent contradiction. In the third and fourth paragraphs of the purport, we read two statements. A, first statement. The living being is discouraged from sin and encouraged toward goodness without suffering any significant interference with his free will as an eternal soul. And then we have the next sentence in the, I think in the last paragraph. In contrast to the material nature, the Lord exhibits his essential nature in the spiritual world where he reciprocates the eternal love of his pure devotees. Such loving affairs are based completely on the mutual freedom of the Lord and his devotees, not on a mechanical reciprocation of coinciding selfish interests. Now, am I the only one who saw an apparent contradiction here? Maybe it's just me. Did anyone see something somewhat contradictory here? Well, what I was seeing was that no significant interference with his free will. But then we're hearing that the thing we like to do more than anything else is reciprocate with other persons, try to engage in, you know, nice relationships with others, even loving relationships. But here we're seeing that really it's not what it seems to be. It's not really so free. Rather, it's just on a mechanical reciprocation of coinciding selfish interests. That word mechanical certainly implies something deterministic, some lack of free will. Is that okay? Is there? Can you see a trace of apparent contradiction? If not, I won't go on with this point because then it's just I'm in my little bit. I'm not getting either positive or negative. Yes, Prabhu. No. I guess Vidyananda Maharaj's language is some of his senses are quite compact, quite loaded. The second statement was referring to the Lord's essential nature in the spiritual world, where he reciprocates the eternal love of his pure devotees. As contrasted, that's based on freedom. And then Maharaj is contrasting that freedom with the mechanical reciprocation of coinciding selfish interests, which we find in the material world. So I was just seeing that mechanical reciprocation idea seems to run counter to this idea of minimum interference with our free will by the laws of karma. So and just one thing I want to include here, it's kind of entertaining, I think. Vidyananda Maharaj used to come up with these most incredible analogies. Srila Prabhupada said he had a transcendental brain. Now, he may be still doing it, but I doubt if he's doing it with the same frequency, or maybe he used them up. But he came up with so many amazing analogies. And I may have heard these 35 years ago, and I can't forget some of them. And one of them really stuck in my mind, and really it kind of links nicely with what we're hearing here about mechanical reciprocation of coinciding selfish interest, referring to the attempt at loving exchange in the conditioned state, where, you know, it's often not real love, and it's not really free. It's just we're compelled by our conditioning and our material desires, so we form these alliances, mutual back-scratching, mechanical. So one of Maharaj's analogies was pretty amazing. I don't know if any of you would remember this one. He was describing a situation where... let me do my glasses. You know, he's describing a situation where two very old friends haven't seen each other since their teenage years, and they used to be best friends. And then, you know, maybe 20 years later or something, they both happen to be on the same construction site. Nothing to do with Big Bang construction. It's a different analogy. They happen to be on a construction site. And it turns out that each of them is driving a D12 Caterpillar tractor. I mean, you got D8, D10. D12 is getting there. It's almost the biggest size. It requires a little gasoline engine that you have to pull a string, and then the gasoline engine is just there to start the main engine. You can't use electricity to do it. It's so powerful motor. So here they are, moving like tanks. And they both recognize each other on the construction site. Oh, you know, Gilbert, Murray, whatever their names are. You know, they're waving to each other, and then they just spontaneously want to embrace each other, so they put, you know, as fast as they can, they put their big machines and they start approaching each other. And when the machines meet, the machines start kind of banging into each other and kind of clicking each other, and there's a frustration there. Because the two men, they want to embrace each other, but they're obliged due to the company regulations. They can't get out and stop running the machine. So they're trying to express their love in this big mechanical arrangement machine. And you can imagine the frustration. So although in the material world it may seem that we're really embracing each other and we're really reciprocating, but at the end of the day, as the Rolling Stones said, you can't get no satisfaction. At the end of the day, there's frustration. Because the machine may be a little satisfied sometimes, but we're not these machines. And we want something more. We want something more. So I thought that kind of fit in. Now, what would be a suggested adjustment of this apparent contradiction that I tried to point out? I don't know how many of you got it. Well, for whatever it's worth, I'll just read quickly. These two statements which mention our freedom only seem to be contradictory, for although our free will is not completely removed, it really doesn't much come into play in material relationships described here as mechanical reciprocation of coinciding self-interest. It appears that in the material context, we have to dig deeper to find the epistemic platform, which means, like Prabhupada would say, like, for instance, Bhagavad Gita, there are different epistemic platforms. There are different faculties. There's a hierarchy of faculties in Driyani Paranyahur, Indriya Bhya Paramanaha, what is it? Yobude Parashashtusha. That on the lowest level we have the sense objects and of course the senses, and then we have the mind, and higher than the mind is the intelligence, and even higher is the spirit soul himself. So we have to go deeper. It can't just be sentimental, it can't just be mind and senses. We have to go to a deeper level, and that's what I was trying to indicate in one other class here. Was that I was repeating Rabindra Sarup's proposal that placing our faith, which is our ultimate paradigm choice, is an act of buddhi. It's an act of real intelligence. It's not just on the mental platform. Where we decide to place our faith, and as I mentioned, most of the time it's not even conscious. We kind of like yield our power of attorney to our material conditioning. We don't actually take advantage of the opportunity to make that fundamental choice, which is where our free will really, really prevails. Am I going to serve Krishna or am I going to serve Maya? And I had the class the other night on 269 Bhagavad Gita. Is it going to be intelligence used for sense gratification and for material comfort, or is it going to be intelligent used for self-realization, even sometimes at the expense of material comfort? So that would be a level of fundamental paradigm choice, or the act of placing our faith, an act of buddhi. Unfortunately, that crucial choice is often made by default, in other words, unconsciously. Or to put it another way, as I just mentioned, we've granted the power of attorney to our senses and mind. So even the fundamental choice pertaining to our faith, even that opportunity to exercise our limited free will, is or was often missed. Nonetheless, we enjoy or suffer the consequences. Now I got myself confused. I know when I wrote this, it was an adjustment to this question of does it seem contradictory that Krishna has allowed a lot of free play of free will in the material world. I guess what I was trying to point out that you have to go deeper to find that arena of our exercise of our actual free will, and that's that fundamental paradigm choice that Krishna delineates in Bhagavad Gita when he talks about the night and day. What is night for one is day for the other. One is a sage, the other is materialist. Okay, now you have some question on that. For further consideration, or in the way of a car park question, does Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita support Krishna's argument herein? In other words, does Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita support Krishna in the Bhagavatam that we're hearing now in verses such as 13:21, Karya Karana Kartritve, etc., where Krishna says that the material nature is the cause of all material causes and effect, while the living entity is the cause of his various sufferings and enjoyment in the world. Or also Udasina Vadasino in chapter 14, where it says that the transcendentalist, the person who's beyond the modes of material nature, he can see that the modes alone are active. So that seems to be in one sense, maybe superficially supporting what Krishna said here. But again, that's a car park question. We won't even try to deal with that. I think there were more pertinent questions that came up. So we discussed in some, hopefully some coherence, I hope, that the Supreme Lord is never subject to his own laws. The conception of God and the conception of absolute truth are not on the same level. The modern scientist's fundamental fallacy, thinking that everything just happened by chance, and the laws of physics, even the laws of physics just happened by chance. And then that apparent contradiction, which is probably complex. So those are the things that we touched on. So yes, Pushkar Prabhu. That's text 14 in chapter 5.
Yeah. That, that contradicts. The Supreme Lord is not. You have the direct English there? But
yeah, I'll read the English to it. Chapter 5.
14? Was that
text 14.
Achasya Sarabhuteshu.
Karma Phala Samyoga. The embodied spirit, master of the city of his body, does not create activities, nor does he induce people to act, nor does he create the fruits of action. All this is enacted by the modes of material nature. Yeah, that seems, you can use that as an argument for Karma Mimamsa, which Krishna's arguing here, but that, is, I think, is mostly showing the restriction that the living entity, I mean, that's a whole topic. The living entity is actually a doer by his desire, but the living entity is not the direct doer. It's like a child is trying to lift a weight, and the father comes behind him, unseen by the child, and the child thinks he's lifting the weight. Actually, the father is sticking his hands, you know, under the bar of the barbells, and the father is lifting the weight, and the child feels he's become Superman.
What about that verse in 18th chapter?
We'll get to that. We'll get to that. Let me just finish this example. So actually, the question is, who's lifting the weight? Who's the doer? Is it the father or the child?
What? You said they're the modes of nature, right?
Well, just in this example, superficially you might say it's the father or some other factor, but actually the child is a doer because the child had that desire and the father picked up on it. So the father interacted, just like the super soul. You know, that's why we get some blame in the matter due to our desires. You wanted to refer to the 18th chapter verse? Or?
Well, I was just thinking that covers everything, the Panchaitani Mahabaho. Mm.
Five factors of action.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that includes also Taivam Chaivatra Panchama. It includes ultimately the super soul. The super soul, that corresponds to what Lord Kapiladeva refers to as Daivi, or that divine guidance. There's someone in charge there. And also that the different types of endeavor also means, like we say, God helps those who help themselves. So how much endeavor, what kind of endeavor we're making, also is one of the five factors of action. So we get at least two out of the five, which seem to be non-mechanical or something to do with free will. Maybe Trivikram.
Upadrashta Anumanta cha. You have to get permission, Anumanta.
Yeah, Krishna is the overseer and the Anumanta. That means he's the permitter. So everything, he has to give sanction, but he also gives sanction for the whole system, that there's some room to play. Just like the Varnashram system, you give some room for the Vaishyas to play. They can have capitalism restricted, but it's not like unlimited, like it is nowadays where everything's completely a disaster.
What about that at the end of the 13th chapter, that one who sees is simply the living entity interacting? How does that start?
That's Kshetragya.
Samyogam.
Well, that's a little before the end, the very last verse of the chapter.
Not the very end, no.
Oh, yeah.
One who sees that...
Yavat Sanjayate Kinchit.
Yavat Sanjayate Satvam Stavara Jangamam.
Jangamam. Kshetra Kshetra Gyor.
Avam.
And then it's.
Subhavas Tu Pravartate.
No, that's Vakshami Bhadatarshava. I'll talk about that now. The Prabhupada says somehow they become tied up. That gets into some complex issues. We better put that on hold so others have a chance. Okay, Chivakram, is that in the corner? Is that Steve D? Yes, it's
so
Steve
the Lord is saying,
the professor.
In my unmanifested form, I pervade and control the whole universe. Maya tatam hidam sarva. See? So it seems there that the absolute truth is synonymous with the supreme control or the supreme Lord.
I'm sorry, what was the verse you were referring to?
Maya tatam idam sarvam.
Maya tatam idam sarvam.
In my own manifested form,
I pervade and
control the whole universe. So it seems like the absolute truth and the supreme controller are synonymous to it.
They sure are.
He did.
It's just the absolute truth is Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan. So that a really apparent contradiction, it seems so contradictory, that verse you're referring to, is resolved to a certain extent by seeing that the all-pervasive nature, the non-different nature, is more relating to Paramatma, whereas the transcendental, that aloof aspect, is related to Bhagavan. In other words, Krishna is everything, but avishishyate, what is that? How's that? The last invocation of Ishopanishad, Jatav. What is that? Avishishyate. Yeah. What's the last line? Purnam eva avishishyate. In other words, he's not just everything; he's more than everything. That's Bhagavan. He's beyond. He's transcendental to everything. He's not just immanent and everything. I think, Madan Mohan Prabhu. I think that Stita Di Muni had a question for you. Did you, Steve? Yeah, he was first, and you're next.
Yeah, I'm a little bit I'm a hopeless contrarian here, so.
All right, it's stimulating.
Well, it's about the science thing. It's true that in modern, in the modern world, the ideas of chance and the laws of physics without God can explain everything, but I think actually that a large percentage of scientists believe all kinds of things as far as their metaphysics go. A lot of them are Christians. To say things like all of them insist that, chance is the foundation of reality may not be entirely accurate. But in the public imagination, that's there, so it is a powerful preaching point, depending on.
Well, that's Stita Di Prabhu. That was a rhetorical error on my part, if I generalized. I mean, I've known a few scientists, and one of them I introduced to Sariputta, and he was very impressed with Sariputta. They had a long discussion right in the BI house here, and he was very impressed with Sariputta, but he's with all due respect, he's a rascal. He's one of those that is completely, fanatically, saying that Darwinism is not even a theory. It's an actual fact. It can't be even questioned. Whereas there's another scientist we mentioned in a class last night, Michael Behe, who's he had a small book, an interview with Bhakti Swarup Damodar Maharaj, and he's wonderful, and he's done tremendous service in his writings, showing the very, very deep questions that Darwinism should provoke. And if I said all them, and if I used that kind of language, it's just a rhetorical error. I stand corrected, but it's not, the essential point is still there. There is that mindset, which is what you call scientism instead of science, as Nagaraj wrote in that editorial in Back to Godhead magazine.
Yeah, it's that scientism thing.
I'm not saying all scientists are into scientism, but there is a big, the scientific establishment Nowadays, like there's that movie by Ben Stein, the protagonist in the movie, called Expelled, No Intelligence Allowed. And it's showing how you try to question Darwinian evolution, and you know, and you get really what you might say ostracized.
Well,
or,
okay, but that was a pretty slanted movie. It's like someone coming in here and questioning the authority of the GBC.
See the deal? You've been brainwashed by the scientific
establishment. Get away with it, but if you don't have that proper mood, you know, you're going to cause unnecessarily.
Again, it doesn't mean every single case pertains, but that is the tendency. Well, Madan Mohan was so anxious to ask a question. Okay, please, we'll try to stick to a particular point.
Well, the point that I kind of an overview see is that Krishna is the most intelligent. He's playful, it mentioned. And there's an intrigue in how he sets up existence, because he says bhakti mama bijanati, I'm only understood by love, by devotional love. So everything that's going on in the material world and in the spiritual world is based on that love. It's in everything. So because of people's the lack of surrender, he gives all these other activities to do and puts it in a confusing way. Not exactly confusing, but in a way that it's challenging all of their different points. He's always challenging all the points. And there's an intrigue in that. They call it the mystery. Enter into the mysteries of my understanding. So he likes to do
yeah,
that.
Yeah, from Krishna comes knowledge, remembrance, and forgetfulness. He can give you the intelligence to become a first-class atheist, if that's what you want. Was there someone here first who was waiting to ask a question? No? Okay. Another Yamaraj. Das Prabhu.
Hari Bol, Prabhu, thank you for a nice class. I was thinking in my mind when you were talking about going deeper, and so this question coming in my mind is that, so do we, you know, it says inevitably to go really deeper, we should take sannyas or something like that. So for people who are like myself, does that mean that we have to take a sannyas in another life, or what? Can you explain that a little bit? Or?
You don't have to take sannyas to go deeper. I can assure you of that. You can go very, very, very deep, and you can even be sannyas, anashita karma phalam, etc. He's the real sannyas, not he who lights no fire and performs no work. It's just that I do recommend some of the men. I was just talking about to one of them yesterday. Don't worry, he's not married. I'm not stealing him away from any lady. And I was, you know, thinking that in this particular case, he might not just go deeper, but become more vibrant and more enlivened and more fully engaged if he took sannyas. He seemed to have all the qualifications. So in that sense, in my own experience is it's pretty exciting. I mean, you have, as they say, lots more opportunities for preaching. And that's, to me, it's a great mercy. Okay, now there was someone else.
I had a quick point. Last night I was looking at a documentary on evolution, really. And these scientists, they have practically thousands of finches. And they're probably trying to prove that.
Thousands of what?
Finches, you know, like Darwin.
What are finches?
They're small birds that Darwin was experimenting with.
Finch.
Finch, yeah.
Finches, oh, they're the birds.
Yeah, yeah. So they were. He was trying to prove that the beaks were changing due to evolution. And so because of
they
that,
were.
These guys kill...
They
like
were changing due to evolution. There is a certain scope where Darwinian evolution prevails. There could be very minor tweaks, and in very limited contexts, and in certain very special set of circumstances, Darwinian evolution reigns supreme. But it's very, very limited. The edge of evolution is very low. Most of the changes are...
Yeah,
require some... intelligent design. Yes, D2D, take the microphone.
I mean, I think that's the intelligent design argument promoted by the Discovery Institute, which I think has its valid place and can be engaged, but I think you'll find Prabhupada's argument was a bit more broad. That's my humble
opinion. Prabhupada's arguments are
complex, a little bit more sophisticated than that.
Prabhupada's arguments are more sophisticated than the intelligent design
yes,
argument?
Yes, what's being...
Well, Prabhupada was much more sophisticated in every way. But...
So I think we can engage that line of argument, but it's not essential or part and parcel of the Gaudiya Vaishnava argument and critique of
Well, it's... yeah, okay, I agree. It's something that could be engaged. I mean, the intelligent design argument, using the word sophisticated, in this case less sophisticated, it's extremely sophisticated within a certain sphere.
Yeah, so it has its value.
It does not even pretend to address itself to the difference between matter and spirit. It's content to even, you know, for the sake of the argument, or even they may not have any realization that there is spirit. All they're talking about is that the machinery of the life forms, and maybe that's all there is, and they're not arguing that there's anything, that there's anyone home inside. They're just saying the machinery of the life forms is just too complex, irreducibly complex, and it goes way beyond that in his second book. So it's, I think it's valuable. And all right, we're really running out of time now, so we'll make one, I think that's it, yeah, okay. Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Granth Rag Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai.